Inside the bug is a cylinder of compressed air, a normal scuba cylinder, and this provides power to spin the two propellers which push the bug forward and also supplies air down a flexible tube to a free-floating regulator. A regulator is the thing you stick in your mouth which gives you your air when you're diving. The point of this arrangement is that you only need your mask and flippers. You don't need to carry a scuba tank on your own back, because you're getting your air direct from the sub-bug. The bug is designed in such a way that you can set a maximum depth beyond which it will not go. The very maximum, anyway, is 30 feet. Ian had received a flurry of faxes from Martin Pemberton about setting up the machine and was pretty confident about it. "No worries at all," he said, and asked me what I planned. I said it might be an idea to take it for a shallow local tryout before taking it out into deep water. "No worries," he said. I said that we could then take it with us on the proper diving expedition that was going out from the island the following morning. "No worries," he said. "So I will then spend a little time trying it out, getting used to it and putting it through its paces around the reef." "No worries," he said. "And then," I said, "for the purposes of this article I have to write, which is by way of being a sort of comparative test drive, I want to try the same thing on a manta ray." "No chance," he said. "No chance at all." I suppose I should have foreseen this. Or perhaps it was just as well that I hadn't foreseen it. If I had foreseen it, I wouldn't have been standing there half in a wetsuit looking out at the glittering Tasman Sea and thinking, "Oh, damn." I would have been sitting fiddling in my office in Islington, wondering if I'd done enough work yet to justify going out and getting a bun. The issue was very simple. As someone who has spent over 2 years working on ecological projects, the very first thing I should have realized was that you don't disturb the animals. It might have been all right to try and mount a manta ray 10 years ago when first I heard about it, but not now. No way. You don't touch the reef. You don't take anything. No shells, no coral. You don't touch the fish, except maybe a few that it's okay to feed. And you certainly don't fuck about trying to ride manta rays. "Hardly any chance you'd be able to get near one anyway," said Ian. "They're very timid creatures. I guess some people have managed to get to ride on a ray in the past, but I would imagine it would be very difficult. But now we just can't allow it." No, I said, rather shamefacedly. "I understand, believe me. I just really hadn't thought it through, I guess." "But we can go and have some fun with the sub-bug," said Ian. "No worries. We can take some pictures, too. That's a hell of a camera you've got there." We now come to another rather embarrassing part of the story about which I have so far been extremely silent. Some very nice people at Nikon Cameras in England had lent me for this trip a brand new Nikonos AF-SR underwater autofocus camera, which is about £15,000 worth of the most sexy and desirable and fabulous camera equipment in the world. The camera is just wonderful, brilliant technology. Really, you want to take a photograph underwater? This is the perfect thing. It's an astonishing bit of kit. Why am I going on about it like this? Well, I spend a lot of time working on a computer. And because I am used to using a Macintosh, I hardly even bother to read manuals, and so I didn't really bother to read the manual for this camera. I realized that when I got the films back. Please, I really don't want to say any more, except to say thank you very much, Nikon. It really is an awesome camera, and I hope very much that you will let me borrow it again one day. I won't mention the camera again in this article. We took a small dinghy out to a tiny deserted island about 10 minutes away. Ian and I spent a happy hour or so pootling around with the bug. We dealt with a couple of problems, a grain of sand in a valve and so on. We worked out that the bug didn't work too well in very shallow water when it had to work against a tide. Well, we'd take it deeper tomorrow. Jane lay in the sun on the beach and read a book. After a while, we got back in the dinghy and went back to Hayman. Not much of a story in all that, I suppose, but the reason I mention it is that I remember it very vividly, and one of the shortcomings I sometimes feel of somewhere like, for instance, Islington, is the lack of any immediately accessible tiny islands that you can spend the afternoon pootling around with sub-bugs on. Just a bit of poignant thought, really. We don't even have any decent bridges you can deface. There were about 10 of us on the dive boat the following morning. The hotel is so spacious and rambling that you don't often get to see many of the other guests, but it was interesting to begin to realize how many of them were Japanese. Not only Japanese, but Japanese who held hands and gazed into each other's eyes a lot. Hayman, we discovered, was a major Japanese honeymoon destination. The sub-bug sat up on the back of the boat, and I sat looking at it as we made the hour's journey out to the reef. Hardly any of the Barrier Reef Islands are actually on the reef itself, except for Heron Island. You have to get there by boat. I was very excited. Apart from a couple of refresher dives in pools, this was my first proper scuba dive in years. I absolutely love it. I'm one of those people who has been tantalized by the flying dream for years, and scuba diving is the closest thing I know to flying. And for someone who is 6'5" and less sylph-like than, to pick a name at random, the Princess of Wales, the sensation of weightlessness is an ecstatic one. Also, I usually vomit on the way back, which is a good way of working up an appetite. We reached the reef, moored, got into our wetsuit gear, and prepared to dive. At low tide, the reef usually breaks the surface of the water. You can even walk on it, though that is now discouraged because of the damage it can cause. Even when the tide is high, though, reef diving is not a deep diving sport. Most of what there is to see lies in the upper 30 feet, and there's really any cause to go deeper than 60 feet. The very deepest a sports diver can go is about 90 feet, but there's really not a lot of point. You're usually looking at bare rock rather than coral at that depth, and Boyle's Law means that you use up your air much faster down there. Also, you have to spend much more time on the surface between dives if you're not going to get the bends. The sub-bug keeps you at a safe maximum depth of 30 feet. I wanted to do a regular dive first to get my bearings. Two at a time, we clamped our masks and regulators to our faces, did the big stride off the diving deck back of the boat, and dropped into the water in an eruption of bubbles. A moored dive boat always attracts the attention of a lot of local fish, who expect, usually rightly, that they will get fed. The ones you'll get to see if you're lucky are the Maori wrasses, which are extraordinary pale olive-green creatures about the size of a Samsonite suitcase. They have large, protuberant mouths and very heavy, protuberant brows. But the reason for the name Maori wrasse, any Australian will assure you apologetically, is because of some paint-like markings on their brow. Australians are not racists anymore. There were quite a few wrasses about the boat, and I made the mistake of getting between a couple of them and some pieces of bread that someone had thrown from the boat. The animals blithely barged past me to get at the food. I sank down to the reef in the huge space of water and light beneath the boat, and drifted easily round it for a while to get used to being underwater again, and then came back to the boat to divest myself of my scuba tank and collect the sub-bug. Together, Ian and I hauled it into the water. I got myself into position behind the thing and started it up. One of the curious features of scuba diving is that your suit and equipment seem so heavy and cumbersome and unwieldy on the surface, which is one of the things that tends to frighten beginners. But once you descend below the water level, everything begins to flow smoothly and easily, and the trick is to exert yourself absolutely as little as possible in order to conserve oxygen. It is almost, by definition, the least aerobic sport there is. It won't make you fit. At first, I was disappointed that the sub-bug wouldn't move me faster than I could swim. We were gently pulling our way down, but as I started to get used once more to the slowness with which everything happens underwater, I began to relish the long, slow, balletic curves it let you make through the water, stretched out at full length behind it, instead of swimming in the normal position with your arms by your side or on your chest. Following the contours of the reef became like skiing in ultra-slow motion, an almost zen-like idea. I began to enjoy it a lot, though after 15 minutes of experimenting with it, I began to feel I had exhausted its repertoire and began to look forward to swimming under my own power again. I suspect that it's probably a machine best suited to people who want to experience a dive but don't want to bother with the business of learning to use buoyancy jackets and so on. I returned to the boat and we hauled the thing back up out of the water. Well, I'd driven the sub-bug. But over lunch, I was worried about the total collapse of my absurd comparative test drive plan and discussed my thoughts with Ian and Jane. I think we just have to think about the comparative test drive on a kind of conceptual basis, I said, and we have to award some points. Obviously, the sub-bug wins some points for being portable, up to a point. You can take it on a plane, which you wouldn't do with a manta ray, or at least not with a manta ray we liked, and I think that we probably like all manta rays on principle, don't we? Your manta ray is going to be a lot faster and more manoeuvrable, and you don't need to change its tank every 20 minutes, but the big points that the sub-bug wins are for the fact that you can actually get on it. I think it has to get a lot of credit for that, if you're thinking of it as transport. But then let's turn the whole thing around again. The reason you can't actually ride a manta ray is a sound ecological one, and on just about every ecological criterion, the manta ray wins hands down. In fact, any form of transport that you can't actually use would be a major ecological benefit, don't you think? Ian nodded understandingly. Can I get on and read my book now, please? Said Jane. For the afternoon dive, Ian said he wanted to take me in a different direction from the boat. I asked him why, and he looked noncommittal. I followed him down into the water, and slowly we flippered our way across to a new part of the reef. When we reached it, the flat top of the reef was about 4 feet below the surface, and the sunlight dappled gently over the extraordinary shapes and colours of the brain coral, the antler coral, the sea ferns and anemones. The stuff you see beneath the water often seems like a wild parody of the stuff you see above it. I remember the thought I had when first I dived on the Barrier Reef years ago, which was this was all the stuff that people used to have on their mantelpieces in the 50s. It took me a while to rid myself of the notion that the reef was a load of kitsch. I've never learned the names of a lot of fish. I always swat them up on the boat and forget them a week later. But watching the breathtaking variety of shape and movement keeps me entranced for hours, or would do if the oxygen allowed. If I were not an atheist, I think I would have to be a Catholic, because if it wasn't the forces of natural selection that designed fish, it must have been an Italian. I was moving forward slowly in the shallows. A few feet in front of me, the reef gradually dipped down into a broad valley. The valley floor was wide and dark and flat. Ian was directing my attention towards it. I didn't know why. There seemed to be just an absence of interesting coral. And then, as I looked, the whole black floor of the valley slowly lifted upwards and started gently to waft its way away from us. As it moved, its edges were rippling softly, and I could see that underneath it was pure white. I was transfixed by the realization that what I was looking at was an 8-foot-wide giant manta ray. It banked away in a wide, sweeping turn in the deeper water. It seemed to be moving breathtakingly slowly, and I was desperate to keep up with it. I came down the side of the reef to follow it. Ian motioned me not to alarm the creature, but just move slowly. I had quickly realized that its size was deceptive, and it was moving much more swiftly than I realized. It banked again round the contour of the reef, and I began to see its shape more clearly. It was very roughly diamond-shaped. Its tail is not long, like a stingray's. The most extraordinary thing is its head. Where you would expect its head to be, it's almost as if something has taken a bite out of it instead. From the two forward points, the outer edges of the bite, if you see what I mean, depend two horns folded downwards. And on each of these horns is a single large black eye. As it moved, shimmering and undulating its giant wings, folding itself through the water, I felt that I was looking at the single most beautiful and unearthly thing I had ever seen in my life. Some people have described them as looking like living stealth bombers, but it is an evil image to apply to a creature so majestic, fluid, and benign. I followed it as it swam around the outside of the reef. I couldn't follow fast or well, but it was making such wide, sweeping turns that I only had to move relatively short distances round the reef to keep it in sight. Twice, even three times, it circled round the reef, and then at last it disappeared, and I thought I had lost it for good. I stopped and looked around. No, it had definitely gone. I was saddened but exhilarated with wonder at what I had seen. Then I became aware of a shadow moving on the sea floor at the periphery of my vision. I looked up, unprepared for what I then saw. The manta ray soared over the top of the reef above me, only this time it had two more in its wake behind it. Together, the three vast creatures, moving in perfect undulating harmony of line, as if following invisible roller coaster rails, sped off and away until they were lost at last in the darkening distance of the water. I was very quiet that evening as we packed the sub-bug back in its big silver box. I thanked Ian for finding the manta rays. I said I understood about not riding them. "Ah! No worries, mate," he said. "No worries at all." Written in 1992. Who are your favourite authors? Charles Dickens, Jane Austen, Kurt Vonnegut, P.G. Wodehouse, Ruth Rendell. Sunset at Blandings. This is P.G. Wodehouse's last and unfinished book. It is unfinished not just in the sense that it suddenly, heartbreakingly, for those of us who love this man and his work, stops in mid-flow, but in the more important sense that the text up to that point is also unfinished. A first draft for Wodehouse was a question of getting the essential ingredients of a story organized: its plot structure, its characters, their comings and goings, the mountains they climb and the cliffs they fall off. It is the next stage of writing, the relentless revising, refining, and polishing that turned his works into the marvels of language we know and love. When he was writing a book, he used to pin the pages in undulating waves around the wall of his workroom. Pages he felt were working well would be pinned up high, and those that still needed work would be lower down the wall. His aim was to get the entire manuscript up to the picture rail before he handed it in. Much of Sunset at Blandings would probably still have been obscured by the chairbacks. It was a work in progress. Much of the lines in it are just placeholders for what would come in later revisions, the dazzling images and conceits that would send the pages shooting up the walls. Will you, anyway, find much evidence of the great genius of Woodhouse here? Well, to be honest, no. Not just because it is an unfinished work in progress, but also because at the time of writing he was what can only be described as 93. At that age, I think you are entitled to have your best work behind you. In a way, Woodhouse was condemned by his extreme longevity. He was born the year that Darwin died and was still working well after the Beatles had split up, to end up playing Pierre Ménard to his own Cervantes. I'm not going to unravel that for you. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you should read Jorge Luis Borges' short story, Pierre Ménard, author of Quixote. It's only 6 pages long, and you'll be wanting to drop me a postcard to thank me for pointing it out to you. But you will want to read Sunset for completeness, and for that sense, you get from its very unfinishedness of being suddenly and unexpectedly close to a master actually at work. A bit like seeing paint pots and scaffolding being carried in and out of the Sistine Chapel. Master? Great genius? Oh, yes. One of the most blissful joys of the English language is the fact that one of its greatest practitioners ever, one of the guys on the very top table of all, was a jokesmith. Though maybe it shouldn't be that big a surprise. Who else would be up there? Austin, of course, Dickens, and Chaucer. The only one who couldn't make a joke to save his life would be Shakespeare. Oh, come on, let's be frank and fearless for a moment. There's nothing worse than watching a certain kind of English actor valiantly trying to ham it up as, for instance, Dogberry in Much Ado. It's desperate stuff. We even draw a veil over the whole buttock-clenching business by calling the comic device he employs in that instance malapropism, after Sheridan's character Mrs. Malaprop, who does exactly the same thing only funny in The Rivals. And it's no good saying it's something to do with the fact that Shakespeare was writing in the 16th century. What difference does that make? Chaucer had no difficulty being funny as hell way back in the 14th century, when the spelling was even worse. Maybe it's because our greatest writing genius was incapable of being funny that we have decided that being funny doesn't count. Which is tough on Woodhouse, as if he could have cared less, because his entire genius was for being funny, and being funny in such a sublime way as to put mere poetry in the shade. The precision with which he plays upon every aspect of a word's character simultaneously, its meaning, timbre, rhythm, the range of its idiomatic connections and flavours, would make Keats whistle. Keats would have been proud to have written, "The smile vanished from his face like breath off a razor blade," or of Honoria Glossop's laugh, that it sounded like cavalry on a tin bridge. Speaking of which, Shakespeare, when he wrote, "A man may smile and smile and be a villain," might have been at least as impressed by, "Many a man may look respectable, and yet be able to hide at will behind a spiral staircase." What Woodhouse writes is pure word music. It matters not one whit that he writes endless variations on a theme of pig kidnappings, lofty butlers, and ludicrous impostures. He is the greatest musician of the English language, and exploring variations of familiar material is what musicians do all day. In fact, what it's about seems to me to be wonderfully irrelevant. Beauty doesn't have to be about anything. What's a vase about? What's a sunset or a flower about? What, for that matter, is Mozart's 23rd piano concerto about? It is said that all art tends towards the condition of music, and music isn't about anything, unless it's not very good music. Film music is about something. The Dam Busters' March is about something. A Bach fugue, on the other hand, is pure form, beauty, and playfulness. And I'm not sure that very much, in terms of human art and achievement, lies beyond a Bach fugue. Maybe the quantum electrodynamic theory of light. Maybe Uncle Fred flits by. I don't know. Evelyn Waugh, I think, compared Woodhouse's world to a pre-fall Eden, and it's true that in Blandings, Plum, if I may call him that, has managed to create and sustain an entirely innocent and benign paradise, a task which, we may recall, famously defeated Milton, who was probably trying too hard. Like Milton, Woodhouse reaches outside his paradise for the metaphors that will make it real for his readers. But where Milton reaches rather confusingly into the world of classical gods and heroes for his images, like a TV writer who only draws his references from other TV shows, Woodhouse is vividly real. She was standing scrutinizing the safe, and heaving gently like a Welsh rarebit about to come to the height of its fever. The Duke's moustache was rising and falling like seaweed on an ebb tide. When it comes to making metaphors, well, all right, similes if you insist, you don't mess with the master. Of course, Woodhouse never burdened himself with the task of justifying the ways of God to man, but only of making man, for a few hours at a time, inextinguishably happy. Woodhouse better than Milton? Well, of course, it's an absurd comparison, but I know which one I'd keep in the balloon, and not just for his company, but for his art. We Woodhouse fans are very fond of phoning each other up with new discoveries. But we may do the great man a disservice when we pull out our favourite quotes in public, like, "Ice formed on the butler's upper slopes," or, "Like so many substantial Americans, he had married young and kept on marrying, springing from blonde to blonde like the chamois of the Alps leaping from crag to crag," or, here I go again, my current favourite, "He spun round with a sort of guilty bound, like an adagio dancer surprised while watering the cat's milk." Because, irreducibly wonderful though they are, by themselves they are a little like stuffed fish on a mantelpiece. You need to see them in action to get the full effect. There is not much in the Freddie Threepwood's isolated line, "I have here in this sack a few simple rats," to tell you that when you read it in context, you are at the pinnacle of one of the most sublime moments in all English literature. Shakespeare? Milton? Keats? How can I possibly mention the author of Pearls, Girls, and Monty Bodkin, and Pigs Have Wings in the same breath as these men? He's just not serious. He doesn't need to be serious. He's better than that. He's up in the stratosphere of what the human mind can do, above tragedy and strenuous thought, where you will find Bach, Mozart, Einstein, Feynman, and Louis Armstrong, in the realms of pure, creative playfulness. From the introduction, Sunset at Blandings. One or two Americans have asked me why it is that the English like tea so much, which never seems to them to be a very good drink. To understand, you have to make it properly. There is a very simple principle to the making of tea, and it's this. To get the proper flavour of tea, the water has to be boiling, not boiled, when it hits the tea leaves. If it's merely hot, then the tea will be insipid. That's why we English have these odd rituals, such as warming the teapot first, so as not to cause the boiling water to cool down too fast as it hits the pot. And that's why the American habit of bringing a teacup, a tea bag, and a pot of hot water to the table is merely the perfect way of making a thin, pale, watery cup of tea that nobody in their right mind would want to drink. The Americans are all mystified about why the English make such a big thing out of tea, because most Americans have never had a good cup of tea. That's why they don't understand. In fact, the truth of the matter is that most English people don't know how to make tea anymore either, and most people drink cheap instant coffee instead, which is a pity and gives Americans the impression that the English are just generally clueless about hot stimulants. So the best advice I can give to an American arriving in England is this. Go to Marks and Spencer and buy a packet of Earl Grey tea. Go back to where you're staying and boil a kettle of water. While it is coming to the boil, open the sealed packet and sniff. Careful, you may feel a bit dizzy, but this is in fact perfectly legal. When the kettle has boiled, pour a little of it into a teapot, swirl it around, and tip it out again. Put a couple, or three, depending on the size of the pot, of tea bags, into the pot. If I was really trying to lead you into the path of righteousness, I would tell you to use free leaves rather than bags, but let's just take this in easy stages. Bring the kettle back to the boil, and then pour the boiling water as quickly as you can into the pot. Let it stand for 2 or 3 minutes, and then pour it into a cup. Some people will tell you that you shouldn't have milk with Earl Grey tea, just a slice of lemon. Screw them. I like it with milk. If you think you will like it with milk, then it's probably best to put some milk into the bottom of the cup before you pour in the tea. This is socially incorrect. The socially correct way of pouring tea is to put the milk in after the tea. Social correctness has traditionally had nothing whatever to do with reason, logic, or physics. In fact, in England, it is generally considered socially incorrect to know stuff or think about things. It's worth bearing this in mind when visiting. If you pour milk into a cup of hot tea, you will scald the milk. If you think you will prefer it with a slice of lemon, then, well, add a slice of lemon. Drink it. After a few moments, you will begin to think that the place you've come to isn't maybe quite so strange and crazy, after all. May 12, 1999. The Rhino Climb. Great wumps of equatorial heat are coming up at me from off the tarmac. It's the short, rainy season in Kenya, but the sun burned off the morning dampness in minutes. I'm slathered in sunblock. The road stretches off into the distant heat haze and my legs are settling in nicely. Dotted along the road ahead and behind me are other walkers, some striding vigorously, others appearing just to amble, but all in fact moving at the same speed. One of them is wearing a large grey sculptural edifice made out of a painted, woven plastic fabric stretched over a metal frame. A large horn bobs along in front of it. The thing is a grotesque but oddly beautiful caricature of a rhinoceros, moving along with swift, busy strides. The sun beats down. Lopsided lorries grind their way dangerously past us. The drivers shout and grin at our rhinoceros. When we pass, as we frequently do, lorries that have clearly just rolled over and collapsed on the side of the road, we wonder if it was anything to do with us. The other walkers have all been walking for several days now, from the shore at Mombasa, along the main highway to the truck stop at Voi, the local centre of the universe. I joined them here last night, rattling in by Land Rover from Nairobi with my sister Jane, who's been doing some work for Save the Rhino International, which is what we are all here to support. From here, we will follow the road on as the tarmac gradually peters out towards the Tanzanian border. Over the border lies Mount Kilimanjaro, the tallest mountain in the world. It is to the peak of Kilimanjaro that the expedition is intending to climb, a small bunch of Englishmen out walking miles a day in the midday sun and taking turns at wearing a large rhino costume. Mad dogs have thrown in the towel long ago. What's all this, I expect you're thinking, about the tallest mountain in the world? Everest surely deserves at least an honourable mention in this category. Well, it all depends on your point of view. Certainly, Everest stands a sturdy 29,028 feet above sea level, which is, in its way, impressive. But if you were going to climb Everest, you would probably start, if you were using a reliable guide, somewhere in the Himalayas. Anywhere in the Himalayas is pretty damn high to start with, and so, to hear some people tell it, it's just a smartish jog to do the last little bit to the actual top of Everest. The way to keep it interesting these days is to do it without oxygen, or in your underpants or something. But Kilimanjaro is not part of a widespread upheaval like Everest. It was a long time before people managed to work out which bit of the Himalayas was actually the highest, and the discovery was finally made, as I recall, on a desk in London. No such problem with Kilimanjaro. It's volcanic, and stands on its own surrounded by a few footling little hills. When you finally get to see Kili, searching among the befuddling clouds on the horizon, your blood suddenly runs cold. "Oh," you say at last. "You mean above the clouds?" Your whole head tilts upwards. Oh, my God! From base to apex, it is the tallest mountain in the world. It's certainly a hell of a thing to climb in a rhino costume. This crackpot idea was first put to me months earlier by the founders of Save the Rhino International, David Sterling and Johnny Roberts, and I didn't realize at first that they meant it. They raved on for a bit about having acquired a whole set of rhino costumes that Ralph Steadman had designed for an opera, and that they would be just the thing for making the ascent of Kilimanjaro in. They had already been used, David told me by way of reassurance, for running in the New York Marathon. "It'll have enormous impact," they said. "Believe me, really." I began to realize the truth of this as we approached our first village of the day, and perhaps now would be a good point to explain what the purpose of the whole expedition was. It was not, in fact, to raise money directly for rhino conservation. Rhinos, which used to be plentiful on the plains of East Africa, are now hideously rare, but in Kenya they are about as well conserved as they can be anywhere in Africa. Richard Leakey's Kenya Wildlife Service consists of 8,000 well-trained, well-equipped, well-armed, highly motivated soldiers and represents a formidable force. Too formidable, some of his opponents feel. Poaching in Kenya is, officially, no longer a problem. But conservation is a continually evolving business, and we have begun to realize that just wading into Africa and telling the local people that they mustn't do to their wildlife what we've done to ours, and that we are there to make sure they don't, is an attitude that, to say the least, needs a little refining. The communities that live along the margins of the great national parks have a tough time. They are poor, undernourished, their lands are restricted by the parks, and when, from time to time, the odd lion or elephant breaks out of the park, they are the ones who suffer. Arguments about preserving the genetic diversity of the planet can seem a little abstract to someone who has just lost the crops he needs to feed his family, or worse, has just lost one of his family. In the long run, conservation can't be imposed by outsiders, overriding the needs of local people. If anyone is going to take care of the wildlife, then, in the end, it must be the local people, and someone must take care of them. Our route took us alongside and sometimes through the great national parks of Tsavo East and Tsavo West. And it was the people who lived on these perimeters that we had come to visit, and also to help. The £100,000 we were hoping to raise from the walk would be spent on building school classrooms, stocking libraries, and paying for other community projects. We wanted to encourage them to see that whatever problems the wildlife may pose to them, it was of benefit to them as well. As we were approaching our first village of the day, the rhino, with Todd Jones inside it, was in the lead. All the walkers took turns at wearing the thing for an hour at a time, and you quickly learned to tell who was in it at any moment from the way in which it moved. If the rhino sauntered, then it was Giles inside. Giles was an ex-Gordonston Hugh Grant lookalike who had spent the last few years hitchhiking languidly around Africa with his own parachute. His technique was to turn up at airfields with this parachute, find someone who was flying in the general direction he wanted to go, hitch a lift, and then, when the fancy took him, just jump out of the plane. Apparently, his girlfriend was a top supermodel who every few months would find out where he was, fly out there, and then, I'm guessing here, have him washed and sent up to her hotel room. If the rhino ambled along in a genial way, then it was Tom inside. Tom was a tall, Woodhousian man with exactly the wrong complexion for Africa. He had the amiable air of a member of the landed gentry, and when I asked him where he lived, he said in a vague kind of way, "Shropshire." If the rhino bustled along busily, it was Todd inside. Todd was not a mad Englishman, because he was Welsh. He was in charge of the rhino costumes, and had worn them originally in the opera for which they had been designed, during which he had had to carry enormously heavy sopranos on his back. He told me that he had originally wanted to be a vet, but had ended up instead being a succession of animals instead. Any time you see a film or TV show or a commercial which features someone dressed up as an animal, it's probably Todd inside. "I was in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe," he told me. "Guess," he added, "which one I was." One evening he showed me pictures of his family. Here was a beautiful picture of his wife, another of his young daughter, a sweet picture of his baby son, and here was one of Todd himself. Todd was done up, very convincingly, as a bright blue centaur. As Todd Rhino bustled along, suddenly huge crowds of children erupted onto the road ahead of us and hurried towards us, singing and dancing and chanting, "Rhino! Rhino! Rhino!" We were quickly surrounded and escorted the last few hundred yards to where they had prepared a reception for us in the village square. The whole village had turned out to greet us with enormous enthusiasm. We sat and watched, panting in the heat and sluicing ourselves down with bottled water, as the children of the village put on a display of dancing and choral singing that was, frankly, amazing. When I say children, I'm not just talking about 7-year-olds. I'm talking about 17-year-olds as well. It's odd that we don't any more have a comfortable word that covers the whole range. Youngsters? Patronizing. Kids? No. Youths? Sounds as if they've just broken into a warehouse and stolen something. Children, then. The children had written a song about rhinos, which they then sang for us. In the background, Giles had quietly taken over from Todd in the rhino suit, and after a while he joined in the dancing, lolloping and swaying around, chasing and playing with the children, before finally dodging off behind a tree for a quick ciggy. We then, with slightly less enthusiasm, sat through a series of speeches that some local dignitaries had turned up to deliver. Wherever we went, there were local dignitaries, keen to be seen, to be associated with us. Gradually, the whole point of the rhino suit was beginning to dawn on me. The arrival of the rhino and the rhino climb team was something that the village had been looking forward to and preparing for months. It was the biggest event of the year, a carnival, a festival, a holiday. Being visited by a rhino was something that would be remembered by the villagers, and particularly the children, for years in a way that being visited by a bunch of English toffs in hats would not. We were then taken to see the village school. Like most of the village, it was made of breeze blocks and was half-finished. The doors and windows were empty holes, the furniture was just a few rickety benches and some trestle tables, and laid out on these were dozens of pictures of the local wildlife which the children had drawn, and which we were to judge and give prizes for. The prizes were rhino climb baseball hats, and whoever won the prizes, we had to make sure that every member of the village actually got a hat. And once we have collected our sponsorship money, we will be able to complete the building of their schoolroom for them. When at last we left, the children danced along with us for several miles, laughing and singing improvised songs. One of them would start, and the others would quickly pick it up and join in. The words seem oddly dated, don't they? It all sounds rather naive and sentimental to be talking about children laughing and dancing and singing together, when we all know perfectly well that what children do in real life is snarl and take drugs. But these children, kids, youths, and all the ones we came across on our journey were happy in a way that we in the West are almost embarrassed by. The last of the children drops away from us. Our support Land Rover drives slowly past, distributing Cokes and Fantas. Jim, our photographer, is sitting on its tailgate, taking pictures of us with his Canon EOS-1, which I've been coveting ever since I saw it. Kees, our Dutch video cameraman, hoists his lightweight Sony 3-chip up to his shoulder, and pans along the line of walkers. I wonder if there's anywhere in the West that you could find 100 children to sing and dance like that. The following day is my first stint in the rhino suit. I'm much too big for it, and my legs stick out absurdly from the bottom, so that I look like a giant prawn tempura. Inside, the heat and the stench of stale sweat and old Dettol are almost overpowering until you get into the swing of things. Todd walks along beside me, determinedly keeping me engaged in conversation. After a while, I realize he's monitoring me to make sure I don't faint. Todd's a good man, and I like him a lot. He takes good care of people and takes even better care of his beloved rhino suit. I stop for a moment to pour some water into and over my face and catch a glimpse of myself in the window of the Land Rover. I look unimaginably stupid, and I reflect that there is something very odd about this sponsored walking business. It's always undertaken for good causes, cancer research, famine relief, wildlife conservation, and so on, but the deal seems to be this. Okay, you are trying to raise funds for this very worthwhile cause, and I can see that it's an important and crucial matter, and that lives or indeed whole species are at stake, and something needs to be done as a matter of urgency. But, well, I don't know. Tell you what, do something really pointless and stupid and maybe a bit dangerous, then I'll give you some money. I only spent a week on the walk. I didn't get to climb Kilimanjaro, though I did get to see it. I was very sorry not to get to go up it. Though, having seen it, I have to say I wasn't very, very sorry. I did get to see one rhino, briefly, out of the thousands that used to roam in this area, and I wondered if it had any sense at all that all was not right with its world. Human beings have been on this planet for 1 million years or so, and in that time we have faced all sorts of threats to our survival. Famine, plague, warfare, AIDS. Rhinoceroses have been here for 40 million years, and just one threat has brought them to the brink of extinction. Human beings. We are not the only species to have caused devastation to the rest of the world, and it must be said in our favour that we are the only one that has become aware of the consequences of its behaviour and tried to do something about it. However, I reflect as I shift the costume back into a comfortable walking posture and squint forward over its bobbing plastic horn, we do go about it in some odd ways. 1993, Completely Unexpected Productions Limited. For children only. You will need to know the difference between Friday and a fried egg. It's quite a simple difference, but an important one. Friday comes at the end of the week, whereas a fried egg comes out of a hen. Like most things, of course, it isn't quite that simple. The fried egg isn't properly a fried egg until it's been put in a frying pan and fried. This is something you wouldn't do to a Friday, of course, though you might do it on a Friday. You can also fry eggs on a Thursday, if you like, or on a cooker. It's all rather complicated, but it makes a kind of sense if you think about it for a while. It's also good to know the difference between a lizard and a blizzard. This is quite an easy one. Though the two things sound very much alike, you find them in such very different parts of the world that it is a very simple matter to tell them apart. If you are somewhere inside the Arctic Circle, then what you are looking at is probably a blizzard. Whereas, if you are in a hot and dry place like Madagascar or Mexico, it's more likely to be a lizard. This animal is a lemur. There are lots of different kinds of lemurs, and they nearly all live in Madagascar. Madagascar is an island, a very large island, much, much larger than your hat, but not as large as the moon. The moon is much larger than it appears to be. This is worth remembering because next time you are looking at the moon, you can say in a deep and mysterious voice, "The moon is much larger than it appears to be," and people will know that you are a wise person who has thought about this a lot. This particular kind of lemur is called a ring-tailed lemur. Nobody knows why it is called this, and generations of scientists have been baffled by it. One day, a very wise person indeed will probably work out why it is called a ring-tailed lemur. If this person is exceedingly wise, then he or she will only tell very close friends in secret, because otherwise everybody will know it, and then nobody will realize how wise the first person to know it really was. Here are two more things you should know the difference between. Road and woad. One is a thing that you drive along in a car or on a bicycle, and the other is a kind of blue body paint that British people used to wear thousands of years ago instead of clothes. Usually it's quite easy to tell these two apart, but if you find it at all difficult to say your R's properly, it can lead to terrible confusion. Imagine trying to ride a bicycle on a small patch of blue paint. Or have to dig up an entire street just to have something to wear if you fancy spending the evening with some druids. Druids used to live thousands of years ago. They used to wear long white robes and have very strong opinions about what a wonderful thing the sun was. Do you know what an opinion is? I expect someone in your family has probably got one, so you could ask them to tell you about it. Asking people about their opinions is a very good way of making friends. Telling them about your own opinions can also work, but not always quite as well. Nowadays, most people know what a wonderful thing the sun is, so there aren't many druids around anymore, but there are still a few, just in case it slips our mind from time to time. If you find someone who has a long white robe and talks about the sun a lot, then you might have found a druid. If he turns out to be about 2,000 years old, then that's a sure sign. If the person you found has got a slightly shorter white coat with buttons up the front, then it may be that he is an astronomer and not a druid. If he is an astronomer, then one of the things you could ask him is how far away the sun is. The answer will probably startle you a lot. If it doesn't, then tell him from me that he hasn't explained it very well. After he's told you how far away the sun is, ask him how far away some of the stars are. That will really surprise you. If you can't find an astronomer yourself, then ask your parents to find one for you. They don't all wear white coats, which is one of the things that sometimes makes them hard to spot. Some of them wear jeans, or even suits. When we say that something is startling, we mean that it surprises us a very great deal. When we say that something is a starling, we mean that it is a type of migratory bird. Bird is a word we use quite often, which is why it's such an easy word to say. Most of the words we use often, like house and car and tree, are easy to say. Migratory is a word we don't use nearly so much, and saying it can sometimes make you feel as if your teeth are stuck together with toffee. If birds were called migratories rather than birds, we probably wouldn't talk about them nearly so much. We all say, look, there's a dog or there's a cat. But if a migratory went by, we'd probably just say, is it tea time yet? And not even mention it, however nifty it looked. But migratory doesn't mean that something is stuck together with toffee, however much it sounds like it. It means that something spends part of the year in one country, and part of it in another.
End of side 2B.